Welcome to the Final Girls podcast, where we now also do live episodes. I'm Anna Bukutska, co-founder of the Final Girls Collective and your podcast host. If you're new to the show, welcome. In real life, the Final Girls put in events and screenings that explore the intersections of horror film and feminism. And on the show, we are currently looking at some of the best teen horror movies ever made to see what they have in common, how well or how badly they've aged, and whether it's worth revisiting them. And there's one film that's always worth revisiting, and that is Scream. The Wes Craven-directed, Kevin Williamson-written meta-horror comedy that pretty much resurrected the horror genre in the 90s, exactly 25 years ago. Before we dive into Scream this week, a quick reminder, you can follow The Final Girls on Twitter and Instagram at The Final Girls UK for updates, event announcements, and horror memes. We also have a Patreon where you can support our work and get occasional bonus episodes. This weekend, you'll get Clarice Lockery and mine's deep dive into all the cult films that premiered at the London Film Festival a few weeks ago. Oh, and because it is Halloween weekend, I should mention we have teamed up with A Good Folk at Movie to live tweet the arrival of our beloved film Censor on their service on Halloween. So at 7 p.m. UK time, we will be live tweeting from Movie UK the film by Prana Bailey Bond. If you haven't seen it already, please, this is your opportunity to watch it. And in order to make it as accessible as possible, Mubi have given us a free trial, a free 30-day trial for anyone who doesn't use the service yet. So you can go to the link in our show notes and get your trial, watch Censor for the first time, join us in the conversation over on Twitter. And if you enjoy the film, which I'm sure you will, you can also deep dive into the mini series that we produced all about that one film. It's on this feed and also on its own feed. It's a podcast called Censor This, where I spoke to almost everyone who was involved in the making of the film. Today's episode, it's actually going to be a little bit of a detour of our usual programming, in a way. Since it's Halloween weekend, after all, and since it's, well, Scream, and there can never be enough Scream in your lives, I'm actually posting the live show episode that we did a couple weeks back with our friends Mike Munzer from the Evolution of Horror podcast and Becky Dark from Don't Point That Horror At Me, and very frequent and beloved guest of this podcast as well. Please keep in mind, this was recorded live in the Prince Charles Cinema, so the audio can be a little bit spotty and there is background noise to the track. If that really bothers you, you know, try it out, maybe skip it. It is what it is. It is a live show. It's never going to sound as crisp as when we record at home. I personally love the background noise because I get to hear people react to our silly little jokes, and I thoroughly enjoy live podcast episodes, both in the flesh and when I get to listen back to them. So, you know, just a little warning. This recording followed a sold-out screening of Scream on 35mm that we did at the Prince Charles Cinema, and it was amazing. I wish we could have recorded the screening itself because it was a full-on riot. It was funny, people were screaming in all the right places, people were booing at all the right people. There was a few people in the audience who had never seen Scream before and they were experiencing this incredible film for the first time with that crowd, which frankly I'm so jealous of. And it was the first time that I got to see Scream on the big screen as well, so it was a really, really special event, and I'm really glad we got to record a conversation and a little bit of the vibe in the audience from that night. So with all of that said, please enjoy the live episode crossover with Evolution of Horror and the Final Girls podcast on the incomparable Scream. How pumped are you? By the way, you guys, if you've never seen a live podcast recording before, you're gonna about to witness one. Hopefully,
you
won't fuck it up.
Oh, let's hope not. So before we actually begin the recording itself, let's do a little intro. We usually do this at home by ourselves.
Yeah,
in the dark.
That's true. So yeah, so we can intro each other.
Yeah,
should we do
yeah,
this?
Yeah, right? Let's do that. Let's
okay,
that.
So welcome to a very special live episode of The Final Girls. This is a podcast that looks at the intersection between horror and feminism.
Yay! And welcome as well to a very special live episode of The Evolution of Horror.
Woo!
A podcast that looks at the changes and the evolution of the horror film genre, one subgenre at a time.
Yeah, nailed it. Amazing.
Let's kidding, guys. We've been rehearsing all week. Thank you.
So we should probably bring on a guest too.
Yeah. It's not going to be just us. Don't worry. So to help us discuss and debate this extraordinary slasher film, please, folks, give a super big round of applause to our friend, the extraordinary writer, podcaster, the amazing Miss Becky Dark.
Woo!
Hello.
Hi. Can you believe that is 25 years old? Hi. Like, it feels still brand new to me in a weird way. Do you know what I mean? Although, I suppose some things have dated, right? A few things have dated.
Yeah, the whole, like, the he who shall not be named, the cellular bits.
Oh, I love it. What were you doing with a cellular phone?
So good.
But, you guys, to kick us off, do you remember watching this film for the first time? Has it aged for you?
I mean, I can tell you a very specific story about the first time I saw this. I saw it on VHS at my friend Sam Foster's house. She was my best mate at school, at high school? I've been watching this.
Yeah.
Secondary school. And she lived four doors away from me. And my horror kind of intro was occult and ghost films and stuff. And I didn't really do the slasher stuff very early. And so I went into Scream completely kind of unprepared. I hadn't seen any of the stuff that it's referencing. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen anything that was just like one person going around and stabbing a load of kids, really. Like, and so we sat there in her living room, we watched it, and she lived four doors away from me, and I was so scared by the time it ended, I ran home.
Love it. I guess we're all of a similar age, but we all saw it pretty young, right? I was a literal child. I was in primary school. I had older siblings who had rented it on VHS, and I watched it, and it blew my tiny mind. It was pretty much my first ever horror movie. So that was this is literally the film that is responsible for me falling in love with the
Look
horror
at
genre.
You now.
I know, and I think it's funny, isn't it? Because we all probably saw it way younger than we should have, but it's supposed to be a kind of look back at the genre, right? Mm. It's supposed to kind of be a little postmodern look at all of the old slasher movies. Obviously, I didn't know any of the references, but it's, you know, it still works, doesn't it?
I didn't either, and I still, yeah, it's still, yeah. I loved it from the word go. It's mm-hmm. just always right in there, straight at the top. Amazing.
I have a little confession, you guys. I think I actually saw Scary Movie before, so screw
you. Oh, no.
So rather than watching Scream and not getting any of the references from the earlier slashes, you watched Scary Movie and didn't get any of the references from Scream.
I'm a contrarian. I like to do things the other way around. What can I say?
God, that's awful.
But I think I actually saw it at the right age. I was a teenager. I was into this. I was already watching. I had already watched a lot of the 80s horror films, a lot of the original slashers, the Scary Movie, okay. When I first came to Scream. But honestly, I don't remember being as funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny. Has anything about it changed since we rewatched it all together now?
I think it is, especially watching it with an audience, you do laugh a lot. But also what's so brilliant, I think why it's such a classic is that it is funny and scary in equal measure, isn't it? There's moments when everyone's laughing and then a moment later you'd notice everyone was silent. You know, the Drew Barrymore scene obviously is incredible, isn't it? It's like a perfect little short film almost. And it starts off kind of funny and a bit cheesy, and then you find that everyone starts suddenly going, oh my God, you know, when she's being stabbed and her parents are coming home and she can't call for her mum and all this, and you're like, oh wow, it's a proper horror film as well, isn't it? That's the thing. And it kind of walks that tightrope, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think I'm not a huge fan of like comedy horrors, and I don't think this is a comedy horror. I think it's a horror film that has got a really smart, funny script. And so you don't have to worry so much about it kind of, is it funny or is it scary? It's like, I mean, certainly the first time I saw it, like, it's scary and it's violent and it's brutal, but the script is so good. And Kevin Williamson at the time, you know, he really, they were sort of at the top of their game, really, in terms of writing these teen scripts. And so it is so funny, and you get to like know the characters so well, but at the same time, like, it doesn't lose any of that like slasher brutality.
Absolutely.
I think it's one of those as well where, like, I was thinking, there are so many quite extreme goofy characters. There's Doofy. Doofy. That's the scary
There you go. It's not just me. I knew it.
That film really, like, embeds itself into your mind.
Take my strong hand.
You know when Tatum, the cat, comes out, I always think, oh, horsey, oh, you scared me too. But yeah, there's Dewey, who is goofy. That's what I meant to say. Dewey is quite a goofy character. Matthew Lillard's character is pretty extreme and over the top and comedic as well, right? But I think the genius is Neve Campbell's, like, Sydney Prescott. She treats it like she's in a completely straight drama, doesn't she? And I think that is what makes it work. I think Wes Craven directs it like a horror film, and she acts like she's in a horror film. I mean, Anna, I should defer to you to this, but she is not one of the best Final Girls, right?
Of course she is. Of course she's one of the best ones. Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree with that much. Where are you coming from? How dare you? No, but what makes her so great, I think, is the fact that she kind of starts off already traumatized. She's already dealing with the baggage of her mom being murdered. She's already kind of lived through a horror movie herself. So by the time the film actually starts, she's kind of jaded and also incredibly so much more sensitive to everything around her. And I really kind of responded to the fact that a lot of her friends, except her very terrible boyfriend, are kind of all rallying around protecting her and shielding her from it. What do you think, Becky?
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, you see when she's at school, and, you know, the police chief knows what she's been through, her teachers know what she knows what she's been through. And I think for me, like, the quintessential line that sums up Sydney is when she first gets the phone call and she's like, yeah, well, I call your bluff.
Yeah.
Like, she's just not interested in any of the, like, bravado and bullshit that goes along with it. She's just like, she almost finds it like boring, and I love that for her. Like, she's just not interested in getting into any of the drama of the fact that there's a serial killer after her. She's just like, for fuck's sake.
She
really doesn't want any more drama, and drama keeps finding her.
Who can blame her?
She's so unimpressed, isn't she, with everyone in that. For even through the sequels too, every time there's like another serial killer, another annoying man who wants to kill her, she's like, oh, for fuck's sake. Like, she is over it, isn't she? That's the thing, yeah.
But talking about annoying men,
right.
Hey, present company excluded. Oh, okay, thanks. Obviously. But what do we think about Billy and Stu? We've all watched this film a million times, but rewatching it now, I was like, how did I not see this coming when I first watched this?
That is what I think is also so clever about it, because when you rewatch it, it's like, it's so obviously them, isn't it? Like, they even sort of hint at each other at times when they're in the same room as each other. Like, there are moments when they clock each other and they almost tell each other what's going on. Yeah, and I think that is really good writing and acting, that it's sort of right there in front of your face and you don't necessarily guess. I mean, I guess they really play into making it look like it's Billy, don't they? You know, all the way through. But I think because of that, you sort of second guess and assume it's not. But they're amazing, aren't they?
And then you get the bit where obviously Billy gets attacked and all of a sudden you're like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not him. And it turns out it is him.
Do you remember who you first thought it was the first time you saw it? Do you remember who you thought might be the killer?
I can't remember. I can't. Like, again, because I wasn't super familiar at the time with, like, a slasher, you know, the kind of the plot and, you know, I just didn't like the structure of it. And so I was just clueless. But in some ways that was really nice because I didn't spend the whole time sort of second guessing it. I was just like so like transfixed at this horrific thing that I was watching. And so like caught up in the characters and the script and everything that when the reveal comes and you get like these couple of like red herrings and like double bluffs and all that thing. And like, I mean, it does, it works so well. And yeah, you watch it now when you've seen it, you know, 50 times or whatever. And you start to pick out, obviously, those, as you say, those moments when they're sort of clocking each other and across the room. But definitely the first time I saw it, I had no idea.
I mean, it's kind of beautiful, all the little winks and nudges that they give each other. You're saying, oh, this is their movie, really.
What do you think of Billy's, you know, constant attempts to seduce Neve Campbell by sort of using film references all the time, right? He's like, so The Exorcist, so like everything, Silence of the Lambs.
I mean, I really don't want to talk about my personal life. It's not that I've used this before, but I can relate in the non-murdery way. But no, at the same time, like Billy is the worst fucking boyfriend on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from his extremely film bro-y tendencies, he is pressuring Sydney so much. And that speech, I really love the audience reaction to that speech when he's like, it's been like a year, babe. Shouldn't you be over it by now? I'm sorry
you got over it.
Yeah. I really need to get laid at this point. Like, I've been investing 2 years into this thing. Are you over your trauma yet, Sydney?
This is a film where she apologizes for having PTSD. Like, if you want to look at something that shows that it's slightly dated, it's like, I mean, that is a full clinical condition, babes. Like, you, it's fine. You don't need to apologize for that. Maybe we should like get you to see somebody and have a chat.
Yeah, it's but also in some ways it's kind of I think they are so pathetic, those two, right? Like they, as in like Billy and Stu, like in that final scene when they're whining and crying and like, I think in some ways that's dated quite well because like it really is going, look at these two rich, pathetic teenage boys basically that think they're amazing, right? That want to create their own like little movie together basically, and I think it really laughs at them in the final act as well.
Billy makes all film nerds look so bad. Yeah. Like I'm watching it,
me three in our t-shirts.
I am watching him quote movie stuff and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ.
You were literally quoting Scream as it was on.
Yeah, sorry.
Is this what we sound like to other people in real life? I'm kind of a little bit worried now. Do we sound like Billy and Stu's?
I mean, I really hope not. Like, he's so desperate for everybody to, like, get all the references and stuff. It's like, oh, mate, fuck off.
But actually, the one true film nerd of Scream, Randy. Bless him. Kind of turns out not to be such a douchey guy in the end. What do we think of Randy? It's kind of like the, you know, quote-unquote annoying know-it-all film nerd who over-explains all the rules and is obsessed with Jamie Lee Curtis, although that, you know, can relate.
yeah, he's a little bit more the film nerd I would connect with, I think, more than Billy and Stu, right? But yeah, no, he's fun, isn't he? And he is, like, the way he reacted to, you know, people talking through the film or people leaving midway through Halloween, I was like, yeah, don't leave. Like, what are you doing? You know, I think he is the film nerd we can all probably relate to.
Yeah, 100% would be left alone at the party, just like sort of yelling at the TV by myself. Yeah.
It's happened. I've been there.
But we've kind of all talked a little bit about the references and the all the layers in the script are just amazing. The more movies you've watched, the more you kind of see all the winks and nods and stuff and all the references that are so layered, from just direct quotes to character names to pieces of music to shots. But do you think people can appreciate this film without being horror film nerds?
Yeah, I think that's what's so good about it. I think Wes Craven directed just a really great horror film, didn't he? I think and it works no matter what. Like we saw it when we were kids. Yeah. Before we'd seen any of those slasher movies, all it did for me was create an incredible list of movies
to watch,
to check out. Yeah, it's like, oh, Halloween, oh, Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, those were the films I sought out in my video shop after watching Scream. And then you appreciate that film more and more. But I think what's so genius about it is that you can, yeah, I think you can enjoy it on both levels, really, can't you?
Yeah, totally. And I had seen Trading Places before I saw this.
It was Trading Places, then Scary Movie, then Scream.
Exactly. The natural way.
There it is. There it is. So it was making me laugh, actually, just thinking about Halloween being in that film, an old film that they mm-hmm. were kind of revisiting, and it's like, isn't it just mad that now, even right now, there's a new Halloween film with Jamie Lee Curtis out in cinemas right now? It's like, she's still going, it's still happening. Like, we saw Jamie Lee Curtis running around on that TV, you know, all throughout that final act. It's like, we're still getting these with Jamie Lee Curtis. Unbelievable.
Are you saying that we're in a movie?
It's almost like we're in a movie, yeah.
Or is this the ill-advised sequel?
What I also love is that Wes Craven always feels like he's sort of making horror films about something as well. And I think like the good thing about this is that it's not just kind of popcorn sort of postmodern entertainment. It does feel a bit like, you know, when Wes Craven does, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, it's a really fun movie, but also you feel like he's a guy that sort of has something to say, I think, a lot of the time. You know, famously, he was kind of reading sort of newspaper articles about teenagers dying in their sleep, and he made a horror movie out of it. And, you know, he's done all these different movies about these different issues, you know, Vietnam War footage with Last House on the Left. And I think with Scream, what's interesting as well is that it's kind of, it feels like he's sort of commenting on his own legacy a little bit. Like, he's the guy that for 20 years had made movies that people had complained were damaging to children and all that kind of thing. And it kind of feels like he is sort of commenting on that as well, if you know what I mean. Even though he didn't write it, but it kind of feels like he could have written it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and also not just commenting on his legacy as a filmmaker, but on the legacy of, so, like A Nightmare on Elm Street and all the sequels that came after that. Like, it's so smartly done that he's obviously just so self-aware about, like, his influence on the genre, but also, I don't know, kind of the flip side of his influence, where it's like there's all the films that he's made, but there's all the films that have been made kind of with his characters that, as you know, up until New Nightmare, like, just got, you know, I mean, it depends on your opinion and your ranking of the Nightmare on Elm Street films, but, you know, he was certainly of the opinion that they sort of went down and down and down. Mm-hmm. And I love those bits where, you know, he's commenting on that, and it will be, again, if you don't know that, if you're not a horror movie scholar or whatever, you might not pick up on it, and it's just like a fun bit of dialogue. But to have him commenting on this, like, much wider kind of issue throughout the whole genre is just so fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of movies don't create psychos, movies make psychos more creative. Kind of feels like quite a playful line that probably Wes Craven sort of, you know, there is that argument that he's probably had his whole career about, you know, are your movies turning people or children into murderers and all that kind of thing. So I think it's like really playfully kind of dealing with that kind of stuff as well, you know.
Well, yeah, horror movies don't make psychos, horror movies make horror podcasters.
Exactly.
But he did already kind of attempt this meta horror movie approach with New Nightmare, which I have a really soft spot for. Yeah. But it is a little bit, sort of feels a little bit elitist, because it is looking at movie making itself. Mm-hmm. So it's looking at Hollywood, it has all these in jokes and kind of makes fun of diva-ish behavior perhaps at actors, whereas this feels a lot more sober, much more than all of his previous films, in a way where it's like, it's funny, it's self-aware, it's poking fun at himself, at horror history, but at the same time you can't just see it as a straight horror film. And even the set design, the filmmaking itself, all the visual choices are quite of the time. He's not going into this dream world, he's not going into exaggerated shots. It's very grounded and feels very of the 90s, and kind of a time where people, and I guess audiences and teenagers, are mostly staying at home watching movies on their TV, where they're getting a lot of footage from TV news stations and kind of the media. So they kind of have this barrage of images and all this access to new screens like computers and mm-hmm. cellular phones and stuff like that, where it feels like a completely new reality. And Wes, I guess, is at this point much older, but he doesn't seem to at any point be condescending to this new world that is not the one where he came into his own as a young horror filmmaker.
And Kevin Williamson too, right? He sort of writes sort of, like, I guess you could call them kind of aspirational teenage characters when you're young, because they talk like 30-year-olds. Most of them are played by 30-year-olds, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They all look mid-30s. They talk like adults. This is the, you know, everything he did in the 90s had that feel. They live in the most incredible houses. How rich are all these kids?
So rich.
Unbelievable. But there is this kind of, like, really glossy, lovely aspiration vibe when you're young and watch it, right? That you're like, these people are really cool. I want to talk like these. But I suppose it's like Kevin Williamson and Joss Whedon, too, in the 90s. Really kind of launched that that kind of way of talking, I suppose, and the way these kids behaved and were portrayed, right?
Yeah, and I think there's something that it's almost capturing lightning in a bottle with this film, with Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson. Like, they just mesh so perfectly. And to have that, like I was saying earlier, you know, that sort of... And it's not even a contrast, it's like a synergy between the sort of the fun and funny and, yeah, like, you know, quote-worthy script, but also all of these years of Wes Craven's expertise in crafting these, like, perfect scares.
And also kind of really, I think, not looking down at teenagers, and what, because although they look like 30-year-olds and they speak like 30-year-old screenwriters, at the same time, they do really behave like teenagers. Yeah. Like, Billy is basically just a horny motherfucker, and Stu is just so in love with Billy.
Stu is the annoying kid in class that you just want to keep the fuck away from, right? Like, he's a nightmare. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a nightmare, but also, I love him and Tatum in a way, although, you know, clearly he should be with Billy, but, you know, that's like for a spin-off that I've written in my head. But like, they're kind of playful all the time. They poke fun at each other. A lot of them are kind of very insensitive all the time. They're late, they're irresponsible, and they're really overdramatic as well.
They're on paper, I think some of them aren't that nice. Like, when you watch that conversation where the kids are all talking to each other in the waterfall bit, they're all being pretty mean to each other, and they're all talking about how they would kill people and accusing each other and all this kind of thing. But, like, I think those actors are so good and so likable and have so much charisma. I think this is where some of the later Kevin Williamson 90s horror movies kind of fall down a bit, because they're maybe not directed as well, but also maybe those actors just aren't quite up to scratch as some of these ones in Scream, because obviously Scream left this legacy of these other sort of postmodern sort of copycat slasher films, but none of them come close, do they? Let's be honest.
They're not as funny. And frankly, the violence in this film is excellent as well. What did you guys think of the actual kills?
Yeah, go on.
Well, I mean, just talking about the opening kill with Casey, I just remember so vividly that moment where he, like, reaches over her and, like, plunges it into her chest. And it's just like, Oh, right, we're doing this, are we? It's, you know, from that opening kill. And even the ones that, like, are a little bit silly, like the cat flap or whatever. Even with that, like, she's... Tatum is so desperate to get away, and she is so... It switches so quickly from her, like, not taking it seriously, playing along with it, and then realizing she's in trouble, and then she's so desperate to get away. Like, obviously you can see, like, her shoulders aren't going to go through there, but she tries it anyway. And you see it, but then later when Sydney finds her and you basically see, like, what has happened to her, like, mangled head, it's like, it just pulls no punches whatsoever. And this is what I'm sort of saying, I think, with this perfect mix of, like, the amazing kind of character stuff and, like, the horror stuff that, like, really goes there.
What did kill Tatum? I'm always a bit confused. Does her neck snap?
I think it crushes her head.
Yeah. It crushes her head.
I guess it crushes her back as well.
It's quite... I was never quite sure of the physics of it. Like, the garage door kind of, like, goes round like that, and you sort of see it go, like, yeah.
I don't think you have to worry about the physics of it, mate.
I'm always a bit like, because also it flashes, I'm like, is she being electrocuted? But she's very much, something has kind of crushed her or something. Yeah. Anyway, just something to think about. I don't know.
Are you cornflakes tomorrow?
Yeah, exactly. I've often thought about it. But
I did also love, I particularly love Tatum's death, because she's so sassy and so savage to the killer. And I imagine that's, like, quite a teenage thing to do, this hubris of, you know, oh, you're not going to kill me. Are you joking? I'm too pretty and I'm too smart to be killed this early on in the movie. And then, no, everybody's suspect and everybody's a victim in a way. And then they all, of course, like, keep coming back. Because the stabby method is not as effective as Halloween taught us it was.
Apparently not. No, exactly. Stu, by the way, he's one of those characters that people always have all these theories that, is he going to come back in the next Scream movie and stuff? Because, I mean, we did see a TV smash on his head, but he's, like, one of the only killers that doesn't get point blank shot in the head, and there's always all these rumors about will he ever come back or all this. I mean, probably not.
I mean, you know, well, you know, never say never. And also Matthew Lillard has been quite encouraging of the theory that Stu is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And also Wes Craven did make Shocker, so maybe he's going to come back as like a
electric,
like
an, sort of supernatural thing.
Wait, can we get a little audience opinion? Can you guys please make some noise if you think Stu is alive? What about the people who think that he's not? The non-believers, the non-Stu believers. Okay, get out. What's wrong with you, you little faith?
He's doing a lot of press interviews at the moment, and there are, I don't want to get into the, you know, the trailer for the new Scream film or anything, because some people are probably avoiding it, but there are clips of that house, of Stu's house in the new one, so everyone's like, what does it mean? Oh my God. So who knows? Who knows? We'll find out in a few months.
And I mean, we've talked about Stu, we've talked about all the teenagers, but I kind of really want to talk about Gail Weathers.
Oh, please, please.
So is Gail Weathers actually the Antichrist of broadcast journalism, Becky?
No, I think she deserves that Pulitzer. She puts the work in, Anna. She puts herself in danger time and time and time again. She's hardcore.
She always wears the great suits.
The incredible suits.
She's not a great employer, to be honest. She doesn't treat Kenny very well.
Poor Kenny. Poor Kenny. Yeah.
So how has, in the post-Girl Boss era, how do we think Gail Weathers has aged?
Don't ask me that first. You guys discuss that.
I mean, I still think she's great. Like, there's nothing that grates on me more watching it in 2021 than it did when I watched it in, like, 97 or whatever. She's just, Gail is who she is. I feel like, you don't have to scratch too deep beneath the surface to know what she's about.
I really love the fact that we get so much of her, though, because usually in slashers and, correct me if I'm wrong, but we kind of get the media stuff a little bit later on. It's always as an add-on. It's always when everything is kind of already done that the media appears and want to cover the massacre. But Gail is there from the very beginning, and she gets her own character development. You know, she's despicable in so many ways, but she's also then becomes a victim. She becomes part of her own story, which I guess is journalism no-no number one, but at the same time, it makes her so compelling because she continuously puts herself in the danger zone, constantly just chasing the story and chasing the money, frankly. And her motives are so capitalistic and so all over the place. You kind of can't help but respect the hustle, even though she is, frankly, a despicable human being.
I always find it interesting as well that it ends on her, like, you know, with every slasher movie, all the classics, you probably see the final girl, you know, get carried off onto an ambulance or walk off into the distance or whatever. But this is a movie that, we sort of pan away from Sydney and we're on Gail for like the end of the movie, which always feels quite interesting. But it's so much about the media, the pop culture. It's like straight away this massacre's happened, and before we've had a chance to breathe, she's like reporting, and that's how it ends, right? And again, that feels quite deliberate.
It does. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Also, just talking about the reporters, when Linda Blair comes.
Yeah, Linda Blair. So,
I leant over to Dave and I was like, that's Linda Blair from The Exorcist. And you did exactly the same to Rihanna.
I leant over to Rihanna. I was like, that's it. Rihanna must have got it in stereo.
Honestly, what a couple of nerds.
God, we are basically Billy and Stu. Yeah.
I hate myself.
That is awful,
I should add that we are all wearing different Scream t-shirts and we did not plan this.
No.
We didn't.
No. They're good t-shirts. They're very strong. There are some good cameos in this too. I mean, like, I'm guessing everyone knows, but there are some people that watch this for the first time, but Wes Craven makes a little cameo, obviously, doesn't he, as Fred the janitor, dressed as Freddy Krueger, is amazing. Linda Blair. There's probably more, I think, throughout
this. I mean, Fonz.
Of course, the Fonz, you know. Yeah.
Who I completely forgot was in this film.
Yeah.
And he really committed to the role. He, like, got his script notes, he got his one scene that he had, and he's like, you know what, I'm going to give it everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go
horror icon, the Fonz.
Yes.
100%.
The sound effects on those scissors, I mean, for God's sake, so perfect.
Incredible. He's great, isn't he? What a great little... Yeah, he's got, what, two scenes, but... Amazing, yeah. And that's the thing, like, everyone, actually, there are a lot of characters that are in this less than you remember, I think. Mm. You know, even Randy, Jamie Kennedy's character, he's off screen for a long portion of the film until he's back in the video shop. And it's like, but you remember these people so well. It's like Drew Barrymore, obviously, as well, isn't it? Like, these people that have their little moments. They're all so memorable. They're all just great characters.
And we've kind of mentioned the fact that the first scene with Drew Barrymore is essentially perfect. But what do you guys think makes it so perfect?
It's literally everything. Literally everything. Like the build up, the pacing of it, how it starts kind of quite sort of fun and conversational, and then the tone just slowly shifts, doesn't it? It's from that moment when she says, oh, you know, why do you want to know my name? Oh, because I want to know who I'm looking at. And there's that sudden kind of like, oh. Yes. And then it just slowly gets more and more upsetting as it goes on, basically. And yeah, you're not expecting it to be as long and drawn out, I think, as well. You know, that's another thing that makes it different to a lot of the classic slasher movies where it's like, stab, dead, scene over. and you know, she gets stabbed, and then she gets stabbed again, and then she's running, and then she's trying to call for her mum, and then she gets stabbed some more, and then the parents are hearing it, and then she's being strung up, and it's like, it's a really upsetting scene, isn't it? And it starts off in a completely different place, and where it ends, like I said, it feels like this perfect, perfect little short film almost. It's like the greatest opening scene of a movie.
It's the best horror short ever made, without a doubt. And I think, like, as a teenager watching it as well, there was something so, I don't know, evocative about her parents coming home.
Yeah.
You know, you see them driving up and you get that little glimmer of hope. And then they go into the house and it's like, hey, call the police, but they can't. And when the mum hears her on the other end, like, all of these things just feel so almost like spiteful to her. And it's the sort of set piece that in a lot of slashers would have come way later in the film, especially in terms of like the brutality of her being strung up on the tree and, you know, being gutted and all of that. Like, that is that's like a end of the second act, beginning of the third act kill. And they just put it there right at the beginning of the film, and from there it's like all bets are off.
It kind of really sets you up for the total tonal shift of the film that will happen constantly. So even from this first scene, you know, it's kind of funny, it's kind of meta, then it gets a little bit stalkery, a little bit scary, then it gets real intense with the violence. And I completely forgot before we were rewatching this night that her parents come in and frantically try to find her and listen to their daughter dying. That is intense and nasty. And then boom, it's credits.
Yeah.
And you're in this high school and it's all light and there's reporters, everything, there's drama, that the teenagers are kind of lapping up. And, you know, if a murder had happened in my high school, I would be like all over that shit. It would be the gossip of the season. But at the same time, it's like, it's nobody seems to feel it in the same way as Sydney feels it.
And also, it's such a, like, obviously everyone sort of knows this now, but at the time she was the biggest name, Drew Barrymore. She was all over the posters. You kind of led to believe in that sort of Janet Leigh from Psycho sort of way, right? That she was going to be the star. And I think, you know, at the time when all of those other actors were pretty much unknown, I think they were all in sort of TV and stuff, weren't they? But they were relatively unknown. And once you've seen her get killed, Drew Barrymore get killed, you kind of don't know who's safe after that, right? All bets are off. And I remember watching it as a kid being like, oh, by the time when Sydney gets attacked, it's like, oh, she's gonna die now. It's just gonna be like a series of all these characters we get to know who then get offed, basically. But you don't know necessarily who's safe and who isn't, which is also why it's genius.
And what about the guy's motives? They make such a big stink about not really having a motive because it's the millennium or whatever, which is another thing that's really dated really badly. But they do explain a little bit, especially Billy. Billy has
he's mommy issues.
Yeah. Like all good killers, he's got mommy issues.
Yeah. It's just perfect, isn't it? It just, again, makes them look so pathetic. They're just so pathetic. Even that motive of like, she's the reason my mom abandoned me. And he literally says it like that. It's perfect, that motive.
And again, like, in contrast with the fact that her mom was brutally murdered, raped and murdered by them, and yet he is like whining about the fact that like his mum sort of moved 10 minutes up the road or whatever. Yeah. It's just like, dude, get some perspective.
Okay, so the thing I started wondering as he went on his little spiel, I was like, okay, calm down, soft boy, like I don't need to hear this. But at the same time, I was like, okay, so surely everybody would know if Sydney's mom had an affair with his dad, because it's not a very big town, really. Mm. At the same time, at the very least, Billy knows. So Billy has knowingly courted, pursued, and made to, I guess, fall in love with him, this girl who he hates so much, and blames her mother, rapes and kills her mother to punish her for seducing his dad or whatever. And then he still stays with Sydney for the year after that, not getting laid.
Yeah, when you put it like that. He's played like a long game there, hasn't he?
A very long game.
For like a 16-year-old or whatever he is as well.
I mean, the movie quotes pale into insignificance when you really lay it out.
Do you think, this is something I've talked about with people this week, but do you think it holds up to scrutiny as well of who killed who and when? Like, was that Billy? Was that Stu? Would this have worked with the two of them? Because there are times when you see one of them in one place and then somebody's being killed in another. But have you ever watched it with that in mind, thinking, how would that work, or would that make sense?
I have, but I've never come to any conclusive like decisions. No. I don't know, there's stuff. I mean, we were chatting the other day, and Mike, you were saying about like, oh well, you can tell so if the killer holds the knife over his head with like both hands, then that means it's Stu, because you see him do that like when he's got his mask off mm-hmm. in the house, and if they kind of go into the side, then that's Billy or whatever.
I mean,
I don't know how that works out if you start looking at like, you know, who's on the phone and who's kind of hiding in the shadows. And
It's one of those things where there's like countless YouTube videos about here's how it all works and everything. And of course, you know, I don't think the writers, I don't think the cast thought about this.
No, they did. I did read about this. They actually did. And apparently you can tell, I mean, you know, you'd have to literally go kill by kill and analyze movement, body movements, height, because Stu, Matthew Lillard is like quite a bit higher than Skeet
yeah,
Ulrich.
Yeah, really different heights, yeah.
But also they're both very hunchy.
Mm-hmm.
So Skeet is always doing this with his head. Skeet is a ridiculous name, bless him. We love him, he's great, but still. And Matthew Lillard is always hunching, and I think he's really hunching because I've thought about this a lot. He's actually really constantly trying to make himself the same height as Billy, because he's quite significantly taller than Billy, in order for them to kind of appear to be the same person when they're ghost face. Am I reading too much into it?
No more than most fans, apparently.
Sounds legit.
You can also tell that when Ghostface is being really clumsy and he's sort of just like wailing around.
Absolute stacks he takes over some
starlings.
How are these boys not covered in bruises?
Well, do you know what? There's a moment when Stu gets clonked on the head when he's the killer, and then the next day you see him looking at his head in a little mirror in his locker. And again, that's something that fans have clocked as like, oh, there's a clue there that he's got
there
a bump on his head. So they, yeah, it does feel like it's sort of been
Which
worked out.
Which is mean, because then Tatum hits him with a lollipop.
With a lollipop, exactly, yeah, exactly. Just adds to
By
it.
The way, one of my favorite Tatum, in my favorite quote from the Tatum-Stu relationship is when she clocks him on the head with a lollipop and says, stupidity leak.
Stupidity leak. Do you think, what do you think of the ghost face killer in general? I mean, like, you know, compared to Michael Myers and Jason and all of those, he is, like you say, super clumsy, right? All the way through all the Scream films, no matter who it is, they fall down, they get smashed over the head, you hear them going, ah, and all this. But in some ways, I find that a little bit more, I used to find that more frightening as a kid because it felt more human. It was a bit more like Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. This somebody genuinely quite deranged, I think, and real, you know?
Leatherface is just tired. He's not deranged.
Oh, he's had a tough day.
Yeah,
he really has.
Yeah.
Fucking kids.
But actually, I think what really works for me about Ghostface is that it's kind of a dime store disguise, right? Which they say in the movie, which really works.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, not only is he clumsy, but he's also
constantly replaceable. Ghostface himself is not a scary figure because you always know that's a real person, contrary to, like, you know, Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger, who's purely supernatural, and Michael Myers is always kind of in the, you know, in the vicinity of, is he real, is he like resurrected by the runes or whatever, is he a real man or is he not. Ghostface is always a real person. It's always a person who went to find buy a number of the disguises, because you can never just have one of those. You have to buy at least four, because you'll get dirty very quickly. And like, it can be interchangeable people, as this sequel showed us, really, is that anybody can put on that disguise and they can become Ghostface. But he always is a real person. And that kind of makes it really scary, because it literally can be anyone, which really continuously works throughout every single Scream film.
And also something they play with more in the sequels, but even in this one, this idea that all the other kids are running around wearing those masks as well. There's people everywhere. Like, what do you think as well, the moment when Sydney gets attacked in the school bathroom? And there's the ghost face killer jumps out and lunges at her. Is that a real killer? Or is that one of the kids?
I've always thought it was Stu.
There you go. Anna?
Yeah. I think it probably is. It sounds like a dick move, something Stu would do. But also, can we just talk about that bathroom scene? Especially because everyone in that high school, a lot of people in that high school, are so mean to Sydney.
So mean.
So aggressively mean. And I think that's one of the most realistic things about the teenagers in this film, is that they are cruel to each other.
Mm. Yeah. They're horrible, aren't they? Yeah. Yeah. What do you think of the sort of legacy? I mean, we don't want to touch too much on the sequels and spoil them, but everything that came afterwards. What do you think? Are you a fan of Scream 2, 3, 4?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah.
That's my ranking.
Oh, okay. I was like, yeah, there were four.
Yes, that's how counting works, Becky. Well done.
I was like, well, that's good. Well done.
I would say that they get progressively worse.
Oh.
And I know that's controversial.
I think four.
Look at your face, Anna. I'm so sorry.
What the fuck, Becky?
Seriously.
What do you think?
I love the sequels. I generally think 2 and 3 are, you know, they're trying different things, which is what I really appreciate about the sequels of Scream, and Scream as a franchise in itself, is that they're never kind of trying to do the same thing over and over again. Yes, there's the Ghostface figure. It always he always comes back. But as we mentioned,
or she.
That's very true. Yes, gender equality, murder as well. But it's always just, it's the whodunit of slasher films, isn't it? So there's always a mystery, and the mystery is always new. But then it becomes a legacy in its own right. So even within the films, there's, in Scream 2, there's Stab. So there's a book, there's a movie made about the events of the first film. So then the universe expands within the
Sydney
universe.
Sydney is played by Tori Spelling.
Yeah.
Bad
times.
Very terrible times. and kind of every single sequel, not just the second one, I think really pokes fun and builds on what a horror sequel is supposed to be. But then subsequently, all of the films kind of try to do something different. They kind of acknowledge the fact that they're a franchise, that they're trying to not reinvent the first film, not recapture its magic, because they knew that was lightning in a bottle. The characters, the actors grow up. They're grown-ups. They have different lives. In the second one, I love the fact that Sydney is in university. She's in college. She's dealing with PTSD. She's clearly had a lot of therapy already. Good for her.
She's taking self-defense lessons. Like,
exactly.
As Sydney goes along, she adapts to the fact that she is like this, you know, target of all of the goings on. And so every film that happens, she's like, she gets more and more exhausted, poor woman, and more kind of, I don't know, like scrappy and hardcore and just, you know.
Yeah. Is that the other thing that makes Scream different to the other big slasher franchises too? The Halloween movies are really, they've got to be about Michael Myers. Friday the 13th has got to be about Jason Voorhees. But Scream, like you say, the killers are different every time, the location changes every time, the constant is Sydney Prescott, right? I mean, does it have to have Sydney to be a Scream movie?
I mean, I say yes.
Yeah. 100%.
Mm. And Dewey and Gale, apparently.
And Dewey and Gale. Especially Gale, I think. I think Gale, you know, arguably has the best character arc of everyone throughout the whole franchise, which I really appreciate. Like, she grows. Gail is not the same, you know, girl bossing, gatekeeping bitch that she is in the first film. She evolves.
I think we get to see a lot more of her kind of softer human side. I think you get a couple of like just the tiniest glimpses of it in this film that they really build on through the sequels, and mm-hmm. she does become, like, as you say, like she's less of just that one-dimensional, like, super ambitious girl boss bitch, and just becomes this like much more human character. That in the third one, like, it's all a bit parodied, I suppose, but you know, by the fourth, yeah, she's, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens to Gale in the new one.
Yeah, should we finish with any sort of predictions of what we think or what we want to see in the next Scream movie?
Yeah, don't say final.
No, I mean, it probably won't be final, let's be honest. But Anna, have you got any predictions, any thoughts, any hopes for what you see in the new Scream? Stu comes back. Yeah. That would be
okay,
good.
Okay, if anyone here has seen He's All That, you should know. Nobody here has seen He's All That? Am I literally the only person? Okay, well, that's embarrassing. But I'm going to say, I just want more from Matthew Lillard. I want him to come back. He always understands the assignment. He always gives it his all. And I want to see Stu come back.
There are some great posture comparisons of him as Shaggy in Scooby-Doo and the new ghost face. And everybody's like, hey, because he's like sort of hunched. That sort of like slightly like drop-shouldered stoner stance.
God, the theories. I love it. What about you? Any predictions, any hopes for the new Scream movie? Are you excited for it or are you sort of dreading it?
I mean, I always go into this stuff healthily cynical.
Yeah. So you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I'll be pleasantly surprised if it turns out to be good. I mean, I imagine they will kill off some big people. So, I mean, I can't see Gale and Dewey.
Doofy
or whatever you called it. lasting to the end. And who's to say about Sydney? I mean, I don't know. It's tough.
I think my main hope is that I just want it to be scary.
Good.
And good. I mean, good would be good. But scary would be good, because I think as the sequels went on, they lent more into the comedy, right? And again, just watching that on the big screen, again, like, just reminds you how good a horror film is, which I'm not sure if the sequel's quite got that balance. So it'd be good if it was a good scary slasher movie, right?
I expect it to be a very good whodunit, to be honest. I think that's the thing I always appreciate. I mean, slashers in a way are kind of the least scary of horror subgenres, at least for me, because they are quite formulaic. They have a formula, they have their beats, they know what they need to deliver on, and that's kind of what we love about them, the fact that we can predict and also occasionally be surprised, like Scream surprised all of us in 1996. Well, you know, not us, because we're extremely young, we're just 25. I kind of really, I enjoy the mystery, because the killers never repeat themselves, because Stu and Billy never come back yet. We never quite know who's it gonna be. I wanna know, you know, who's, you know, the grandchild of someone that Sydney looked at funny one time in high school. Or like who was Billy's secret girlfriend who he had on the side in the first film. Like all of these additional layers that expand these weird tense relationships and antagonisms. I go there for that. It's like the Agatha Christie film of slashers franchises in a way.
Or the Murder, She Wrote.
Love it.
Slashers, She Wrote?
Murder, She Wrote with like butcherings.
More stabby, stabby. More stabs. Stab, 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 stab.
Perfect. I can't wait. I mean, let's all come back to the cinema and watch Scream 5. Scream 5. Scream. In January.
5 Cream?
Yes.
5 Cream. Yeah.
And we're getting the death note, the death stare, the stabby stabby, we need to get off the stage and let people go home stare. So thank you guys so much for coming out to see Scream with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. It's been a blast. Now we get to go home.
Yeah. Sorry.